So this is Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air, and I am Jim Grant. And with me, as always, is Evan Lorenz, the great deputy editor of Grant's. That's like the Ohio State, or the, I guess, the Notre Dame, right? It's, in any case, Evan, from now on, it's the capital T I'm going with.
I'm going to trademark that as well.
All right. Henry, nice to see you. Happy New Year. And we have a guest today, and her name is Carrie Findlay. And she is friends of ours and friends of others, and they all speak so highly of her, and you'll find out why presently. She is the founder of Tecora, which is an asset lending operation, and they have a couple of funds, and the funds compound money at fabulous rates. We'll hear why in just a moment. In the meantime, Evan, okay, over the weekend, the 47th president of the United States launched his own meme coin, right?
And the Trump coin, and then it went up to like $60 billion or so at its peak,
right? And then came the First Lady, and she I'm not sure if there's peace in the House or not, but her coin took a little bit of the oxygen out of the president's coin, and they both started to flutter down. And then a pastor who gave part of the benediction at the he issued one. He has achieved a market cap, I think, of less than $0.50. So it was all, the best part was the first part. But, I spent the last couple of days trying to imagine among the presidents that I know and one about whom I've written, imagine in this group, who would have done this? For example, Evan, Dwight D. Eisenhower?
I can't quite imagine an iCoin.
All right. How about Honest Abe?
I just can't picture it.
I think especially Honest Abe. I think John Adams, about whom I know something. And nope, the technology was not available to tempt him. I don't see him issuing a coin with all of the attendant risks to reputation, or rug pull charges and legal troubles. The Wall Street Journal this morning has a headline over an editorial called President Trump Crypto Billionaire. And adjacent to this on the editorial page, all these high-minded things about what's he going to do about, Iran and other matters of state. And then there's this item about this guy, president, who issues this coin of no evident intrinsic value, Evan. And it commanded at one point 60-odd billion dollars of what? Of currency, right? Of dollars. Evan, what's a dollar? Yeah. Okay.
My favorite part about this all was every one of the crypto enthusiasts were happy to see Trump in office because he is not putting the hard hand of regulation down on the industry. But as soon as they saw him launch the coin, they felt that he kind of showed the tricks behind the curtain and showed the sheer cupidity of the industry. And they got mad at him for doing that, even though that is what the industry does.
Yeah. The Journal had another story, a news story that preceded the editorial. And the headline was, "Crypto thought Trump would bring it legitimacy." I had no idea that crypto was so fastidious about its reputation. I thought they just winked at each other. Hey, scammer.
Maybe they're better off
What's
launching
up?
A legitimacy coin.
Huh?
Maybe they need to launch a legitimacy coin.
Yeah, maybe so. Anyway, that's getting the administration. Other administrations had to wait a few months after in the office to get a scandal going with, the Harding administration. They had to wait a while for Teapot Dome. In fact, they had to wait after the president died. But this scandal in the making, say I, says the Wall Street Journal editorial page, was right there to start with. So either it's a sign of the great energy of a transformative administration, let's hope that's so, or it's a sign of what we in the trade, Evan, know as really good copy. Yeah. So prior to founding Tecora, our guest today, Carrie Findlay, was a partner at Third Point LLC. That's a Daniel Loeb's hedge fund. And prior to that, she was involved with great names on Wall Street, such as Highbridge Capital Management, I guess, and David Zwirn, right? D.B. Zwirn's company, yeah. And her educational credentials strike me as someone, in particular me, because I am married to a lady who went through the Columbia University MBA program and thought that, and also later medical school, and she thought that operations research is one of the more difficult academic challenges of her many, many yeared academic life. And Carrie, apart from being a known compounder of capital at most impressive rates, is also an intellectual force to be reckoned with. So Carrie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So the asset-backed lending, Carrie, is a phrase of, I think to many people, slightly mystical quality. It sounds as if you were lending perhaps against drill bits or trucks or other hard items you might find on the asset side of the balance sheet of an industrial company. But I've gone through some of the transactions in your very transparent materials, and the assets against which you lend are very heterogeneous. They're all of it. So tell us what it is you do for a living.
Yeah, so we consider asset-based lending is, for us, mostly financial assets. So they can be hard assets, but most of them are things like loans, leases, invoices, receivables, purchase orders, or statutory capital, which also can be known as locked-up cash.
So it's, in part, it's like an old factoring business, no?
Much of it is, yes.
Yeah. And I noticed that some of the interest rates you have achieved are quite fancy.
They can be very high, yes.
What is the average rate of interest you have achieved on some of these loans?
I think we charge mostly between 17 and 21%. So somewhere in the low 18s is probably our average.
Now, it is writ. It is the word within the lending community. If you have to pay that rate of interest, you probably not ought to be lent to, because by definition, you are at death's door. Could you help to dispel that prejudice?
I don't think that's the case at all. You know, I would say that our borrowers, for the most part, aren't buttoned up. You know,
and what is buttoned up? Squared away?
Squared away. Yeah, okay. You know, they're not walking into a bank in a suit with a pedigree and having done this before. And so if you were a third-time entrepreneur of a factoring business,
yep,
and you walked into a bank and you had a book of business and you were starting over, they may lend to you. But if you're doing it for the first time, they probably won't. So you're not on death's door. You're just a first-time entrepreneur. And you're probably venture-backed, yeah, and you probably have really aggressive growth plans. And all these things would scare a bank. And, you know, I would say actually the biggest thing that scares a bank is what we call scaling risk, which is oftentimes we make a, in air quotes, $30 million loan to somebody who's originated $700,000 of receivables. But, you know, the dirty secret is we don't give them $30 million. We give them up to $30 million as they find more receivables.
Yeah.
And so we take the scaling risk, the risk that you made 700,000 of them, but you can't find another million. You can't take five more million. You certainly can't find 20 more million. And that happens. And about a third of our portfolio doesn't scale. And, you know, it's a waste of our time. It's a waste of energy. It's a waste of some legal fees for setting up the deals, but we don't lose money on them, and we're okay with that.
Who's the first vice president in charge of saying no?
Me.
Does that come easily to you?
If it comes, saying no comes very easily to me, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're not watching this, if you're listening to this instead of watching it, you should see that Carrie has a very sweet smile that almost belies the facility with which she can say no.
It's actually very funny. My COO said to me the other day, you know, when one of my associates came to me and asked me if we were going to grant a waiver. And I was like, of course we're not. And he looked at me, he's like, Carrie, you need to have a little more empathy for how hard it is for her to have to say that to the borrower. And I was like, well, I'll just say it then. Like, it just doesn't bother me.
Yeah, well, you have your own money up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carrie, reading through your presentation, it sounds like part of the opportunity that you're exploiting is the fact that certain regional banks like First Republic and Silicon Valley that used to lend to startups no longer lend to them. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I would say that there were times in 2020 and 2021 where effectively we competed against Silicon Valley Bank or First Republic or, you know, Bridge Bank or someone like that. But realistically, we shouldn't. Realistically, they are doing what we call venture debt. Venture debt is if you raise $40 million from a top tier VC, they'll give you 20. But that 20 is really based off the fact that you had a top tier VC. And they have confidence that if you had a top tier VC in your current round, you'll at least get a second or third tier VC in your next round. Even if things go poorly, you know, there are funds set up purely just to follow Andreessen Horowitz. And so if you have someone like Andreessen Horowitz, a top tier VC, Silicon Valley Bank has very high conviction that a second, third, or fourth tier VC would do your next round. And so they are expecting to get paid back by that next round. We are expecting to get paid back by the value of the assets. So we don't care how much money or who put in money. We just care that the assets that we would need to liquidate later have value. And so we shouldn't be competing with them, but effectively there were many situations during the boom time where we could have and would have.
And just to ask the follow-up, So there was a period of time where capital was very cheap and very easy for the venture industry. How is the venture industry responding now that there actually is a cost of capital, that credit is less easy to come by?
I mean, the business is changing. You know, 2020 and 2021 are my worst market. They're my worst market because equity is so easy to come by and so cheap that, you know, maybe our typical customer has like $10 million of revenue when we meet them. You know, they could get a $100 million check from one of those big, you know, fancy growth funds that I'm sure you guys have talked about previously that have now, you know, have returns down 50%. And that money was much easier to come by than ours. Our money comes with covenants. They have to have a borrowing base.
Covenants.
Covenants.
Interesting idea. Yeah. Did you invent that that idea?
I did not. Oh. It was a bank probably 100 years ago, or probably a lender, yeah, probably a single lender,
but
down in Brooklyn.
You have to admit it has gone out of fashion.
It's very out of fashion. But we have to have covenants. Like, we have covenants on the assets. We have covenants on the sourcing. We have covenants on the company, and we have covenants on the founders. Like, as long as they have our money and their money, our money is in that facility, we want to make sure it's being taken care of, you know, with a little bit of care. And, you know, there aren't a lot of people who want to lend money to someone who's only originated $700,000 of assets. And so they have to take the covenants. They don't have a choice.
Okay, I was looking through some of these transactions, and they're all interesting, in my opinion. And here's one that perhaps you could tell our listeners about. Okay, Project Sierra Nevada, which is something called InsureTech. And it's $2.8 million secured note, 30-month term, and the interest rate is 18.5%. And what struck me about it is, among other things, is Tecora collateralized the loan beyond just assets of the business, and included the founder's shares in AcriSure and a lien on his home. Now, who gets to tell him that he's got to move?
That will be me, if we ever get there, which I don't think we will. Yeah. That will be me. I would not make my team do that. But, you know, AcriSure is a very, very successful 20-plus billion-dollar company. You know, this guy was a successful entrepreneur. He sold his business to AcriSure, and he took back stock in AcriSure.
I see.
The problem with AcriSure for us is that it's private equity-backed, not venture-backed. And the reason that's a problem is that most investors in AcriSure invested 10-plus years ago out of funds that no longer have cash. You know, I went to Crunchbase, I looked at who had AcriSure shares, and I called them all up, and they were like, ooh, Carrie, like, that's in fund four. We're now on fund nine. We can't make new investments out of fund four anymore because I'm trying to sell the AcriSure shares and see if we can find a bid for them. And it's been tough, and AcriSure hired, I believe, the head of the NYSE to be their head of their IPO. So they are on the path to IPO. But this is a very rich founder who, you know, has a lot of AcriSure shares, but wanted to start his next business and just didn't have cash and won't have cash until AcriSure goes public. But, you know, we're in a position now where, like, we think AcriSure will go public. We're going to wait for it. We're not. If I was worried for 1 minute that our principal was impaired, I'd tell him he had to move. But the amount of AcriSure shares we have covers the loan multiple times over. And so we're just waiting on it to go public, and we could wait.
How do you value the shares of a company like AcriSure that is in the long queue of companies waiting to go public?
We got some financials, you know, through other sources. We got some financials from private equity firms. There has been some trades, and, you know, on the secondary market, right, we were able to we were able to access some information there. So we just did a triangulation analysis, and, you know, we didn't know. We just knew it was many multiples of our loan amount.
Tell us about, if you would please, the triangulation solution you found. How does it compare with the nth round venture funding, PE funding?
So this is a very successful company, and in this case, it's above. And this company was more private equity backed than venture backed. Yeah. And so my experience is that private equity people look backwards and venture people look forwards, meaning that private equity people are putting a multiple on what happened. Venture people are putting a multiple on what they believe may happen. And so there's a lot more grounding. If it was venture backed, we'd have, you know, a lot more volatility in our analysis about the potential valuation.
But don't these PE people not only just look back, but they also say, let's see, after the successful amalgamation or whatever is this company, look at what we can realize in the way of increased efficiency. And we can make these assumptions, and that's all forward-looking, right? I mean, that's where a lot of these EBITDA multiples become very suspect, are they not?
So that is often the case. And in my experience, that happens more when there's one private equity firm who owns and controls the whole thing. In this case, there's six or seven, which means that there's not one person just doing everything to squeeze out costs.
They have to agree on the fake numbers.
Yes. They have to agree on it. It's a good way to put it. Yes.
Yeah. Hey, so what do you see? I've got a couple of other microeconomic questions in mind, but before we get to them, tell us how you see the world of credit. That is to say, here we had, 8-10 years, depending on how you count them and regard them as, as rhetorically or one may style them as free money years, right? 0% funds rate, as you were describing the venture capital scene out in the Wild West, need 10 million, here's 100. Right, it's kind of free money era. So that has had its consequences, right? It's had all manner of consequences. But do you see, in the wake of interest rates going up as they have, and in the wake of some tightening in terms and conditions of lending, what do you think? Is the credit environment anything like does it deserve anything like the word restrictive that the Fed is fond of placing on it? Or does it more closely resemble the world in which the Trump coin can go up to the moon and credit spreads can, public traded debt can close as tight as a drum and the stock market reach new highs? Which one is it?
I think it's a tale of two cities. I think you have sectors of the market where you can't get credit. I think it's very hard for consumers to get good credit. I think there are industries that are out of favor or like expected to be regulated away. Expected to be regulated away, where you can't get credit. But anything that is going to be backed by a direct lending fund, there is ample and if not excess credit.
Yeah.
So if you are someone who can go get money from, not to call it any specific fund, but the group of like Blackstone, Ares, Apollo, these big mega funds, right. If you need $100 to $300 million, I think you can get credit anywhere you want. But if you need a lot less money, if you're a person who needs consumer credit, banks have really pulled back, not necessarily because of interest rates, but because of regulation and just a hard and bad business environment. And I think a lot of people had a lot of fear of the CFPB, and so they don't want to lend to anything that's consumer related. So I think if you are someone who can get money from a mega fund, you can get all the money you want and more and have many term sheets and a lot of competition. If you don't fall in that bucket, I think it's tough.
So Carrie, a lot of your customers or your clients are fintech, insurtech, VC-backed companies that deal with various finance aspects. Since Trump was elected, the entire public bank equity index has kind of rallied sharply on the hope that they'll be less regulated and more able to actually compete and offer new services. Given that a lot of the VC insurtechs or fintechs often exploit kind of regulation that stifles business that otherwise would happen, is Trump good, bad, or indifferent towards the VC companies you face if banks are better able to compete against them?
If banks are, there could be some companies that don't get started. There could be some companies that shut down. What we do is a little more specific than that. But if you think about like just one of the first fintech companies, obviously, I think PayPal was the first, but one of the first new age fintech companies, which was the Lending Club. The Lending Club, in my opinion, their entire business model was, since the financial crisis, it costs a bank about $1,200 to originate a consumer loan. Because we're not a bank, we can do it for $300 to $400. And so, yeah, it was exploiting the regulation that made it so expensive for a bank to originate a consumer loan. Companies like that, and not necessarily them, but companies like that may not have a place anymore if the costs and the red tape get cut down by banks. And so it could be bad for some fintech businesses. But, overall, I think the smartest people out there will find the most enterprising solutions and will create great companies. There just might be in smaller buckets and in smaller squares back in a corner doing, more specific things that the banks aren't focused on.
Tell us about your credit experience, Carrie. How many loans go bad out of a percentage of how many you make?
We expect about a third, but we don't expect to lose money on those third. So, we have a portfolio of invoices. The company that originally bought the invoices may cease to exist, but it doesn't mean that the person who bought the food and the person that sold the food, and there's an invoice generated, they're still going to pay for it. So, the Targets, the Walmarts, the Krogers of the world will still be paying for the food they bought. They'll still be paying for the goods they bought, whether or not the company that we lent money to exists. And so when the companies are starting to go out of business, we start liquidating collateral. We start letting cash come in. We start letting it build up. We don't allow them to buy any more invoices. So we have pretty tight screws on these companies, and we have been able to work them all out. And so far to a favorable outcome of getting all of our interest and principal back.
What do you think of the great rise, indeed the boom in what is called private credit, kind of grandiosely? I always thought the word private credit, it sounds as if it were a whole new thing, but it's actually like debt. But what kind of inroads has that made? And you know, it's obvious that this thing called private credit has not been through a complete credit cycle, including the scary part. So what's going to become of it?
I think it's going to, again, there's going to be sectors of the market that have real issues. If you go back to 2015, the energy sector had a real awakening. Right. And that was, I think, the last real credit, call it crisis, that I saw was energy sector 2015. I mean, there was a private credit market. It was all within CLOs at the time, levered loans. And the CLOs are the collateralized loan obligation, which is a portfolio of securitized levered loans. And they started dropping, you know, to 2x coupon, meaning from 100 cents on the dollar. You know, let's say the coupon was 6%. That means it traded at 12 cents on the dollar. So that means the loan price declined 88%. That's quite a steep drop.
That's a character building drop.
Yeah. And they were in these CLOs. We, at Third Point at the time, were buying the CLOs they were in after they dropped, and people were scared. So I think that, you know, you will see sectors of the market have that again. You will see sectors, whether it ends up being commercial real estate, which, you know, it seems like it's in a very precarious position, that for some reason just the bottom doesn't seem to be dropping out of it in the way I would have expected. Whether it ends up being a sector like energy or a sector like industrials or a sector like, it could be any sector. Yeah. We will see sector blowups. And I think that a lot of the people in the seats today weren't even, you know, trading these assets, weren't even around during the financial crisis. I think it could be a very harrowing experience.
What happened to those CLOs for which you paid 12 cents?
Well, the underlying loans were trading at 12 cents. The CLOs were trading at NAV, and because it was a portfolio, it wasn't all the way there. But what happened to them? I mean, they rebounded as the energy sector rebounded. You know, we bought at a good time. We got lucky, but they didn't default in the way people were expecting because the underlying fundamentals of the energy sector did recover.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'm going to ask you about a couple of these deals, which struck me as really interesting. One of which has to do with the Project Green. All right, this is, okay, I'm going to read from there. So Project Green, the company operates as the only legal vehicle for U.S. sports bettors to gain access to cash advances through a consumer debit card offered in partnership with Visa and Cross River Bank. Now, Kerry, is this a good idea for the guy who's sitting at home and he wants to bet and he says to his wife, hey, don't worry, we've got a line of credit to bet more.
So it's actually used most by people who don't want to tell their wives.
How did I guess that? I've been married for 52 years.
I would guess you have some experience with that. Yeah.
Tricia, yeah.
So, you know, is it a good idea? I mean, look, they're underwritten. They know what they're doing. They're betting on a debit card. We're just getting interchange. The interchange that the company gets pays our loan amount. Is it a good idea? I mean, you know, I think people should be able to do what they want with their own free will.
All right.
But I don't believe in taking advantage of them, even if they know what they want with their own free will. And so I don't believe that that our company is taking advantage of people. I think they're servicing a need of people who don't want to tell their wives what they're doing.
And by the way, the interest rate on this particular credit is 23.5%.
That is correct. Yeah.
Tell me about, one more. Evan, do you have a question while I fiddle with the...
Well, one thing I'll say is 23.5% is probably cheaper than marital counseling.
It probably is. Or even worse, legal advice during a divorce. Yeah.
So, Kerry, while Jim's looking at the next deal, one question I have for you is, talking to people in the private equity industry last year, a lot of people were betting or hoping that the Fed would cut rates multiple times this year, and that would lead to kind of relief at portfolio companies. I know you have a foot in kind of venture capital and kind of a toe in private equity, but it does seem like the Fed is going to cut less than people had anticipated because growth is stronger than everyone had expected last year, and inflation seems more persistent. What does kind of higher for longer mean for like privates in general, both venture capital and private equity?
It's not good for anybody in those sectors. Venture capital firms are less debt fueled than private equity firms, but it works its way through the system, right? If you had a 5-year loan from a mega cap private credit fund, at 5%. When you go to refinance it, you know, it maybe it's at 8 or 9%. And unless you have the pricing power to push up the cost of your goods and still sell the same amount, you get squeezed. And so it really works its way through the system. I wouldn't say that growth is stronger. My impression is just like inflation is stubbornly high. Obviously, growth and inflation do have some correlation to each other. But I can't figure out why inflation is as high as it is. It's something that I've obviously read about. You've written about it, but it just doesn't feel like, you know, it feels like the labor market is just stubbornly tight. It feels like people are making enough to support these higher prices. It's been very interesting, but I think that in the private equity world, it will work its way through the system. You will see more defaults. I think everyone thinks their company has more pricing power than it does. They think they'll be able to sell the same amount of goods, but on the other side, like, people do run out of money. And so they can't pay for the same amount. They can't pay for the same, you know, 40% increase to go commiserate with the 40% increase in the debt yield.
Carrie, you sound like someone who is cyclically minded, who does not buy into the idea of perpetual prosperity, which always know you have a home here, Carrie, for that reason.
Thank you.
But what is going to end the current cycle of up and to the right?
I think it's commercial real estate. I mean, I don't think there's any sector in the commercial real estate world that is untouched right now. And, you know, at some point, it's going to come to roost. I don't know when, but offices are not full.
Right.
Multifamily is really struggling to push the rent increases that they, you know, especially lower end, that they thought they could. You know, industrial is doing fine. And hotels are doing okay, but you know, there are a lot of buildings out there that are empty. Retail's not great. So I just don't know how those buildings refinance their debt. In theory, that then goes to the banks who made those loans, or the funds that made those loans, or the banks that hold those loans. The CMBS start to have issues, the commercial mortgage-backed securities start to have issues because they can't refinance, and then there's defaults in there. It has to, I think that's where it starts. I think that creates some sort of credit crunch to it's not a full crunch, maybe it's just a tightening. And then the firms that made those loans can't raise money. And then, you know, you start to see an allocation of capital elsewhere and losses taken and pain taken, and that's deflationary. And it's a big part of our economy. You know, I have this very good friend who always says he doesn't like to be in cities where the wealthiest people got rich off real estate. And he just thinks they're empty, vacuous cities that don't have industry. And if you think about that and how many cities that is.
Terry, we're sitting in New York City. Can you not say something a little more constructive about this? This is where Donald Trump come from.
He means L.A. He means New York.
Oh,
he means Miami. Uh-huh. He's not the only one. Uh-huh. But
I thought Miami was art, no?
So
okay, Minneapolis, grain. Okay, fine. Yeah.
But it really is just about figuring out like how that commercial real estate pullback and how the commercial real estate refinancing affects players, and then how that affects other lending and creates some deflation, and hopefully that kills some
of
the inflation.
Okay, tell us how Tekora is going to navigate this coming peril, assuming it happens. You've thought about it, and have you made plans to be extra liquid in expectation of it, or do you have something, you have plans in mind to become bigger and more aggressive when prices are down and when everyone else is tightening?
Yeah, so both. One, most of our loans' underlying assets are relatively short. So, you know, 90-day receivables, 120-day receivables, it can be a one-year insurance policy. Insurance should be a little unaffected because you're really just dealing with perils and losses. But in the future, yeah, I mean, we have vehicles set up to buy assets when asset prices get cheaper. Something that I spend a lot of time looking at is what I call the buy originate credit parity. And so there's times where, you know, if you look back from the financial crisis, 2008 to 2000 and probably 13, it was cheaper to buy assets than originate assets. From 2013 on, maybe that blip in 15 where we saw energy loans trading at 12 cents would be the blip. You know, for the most part, it's been cheaper to originate. Because assets, you buy them at par, you originate them at par, you get more controls if you originate, so you would always originate. Maybe there was another blip during COVID where it was cheaper to buy, but overall, that's what we focus on. And to this extent, the buy originate parity goes back in the flavor of buying, we will start buying assets aggressively.
Carrie, you said a little bit earlier that you didn't think growth was surprising to the upside, it was just inflation. In addition to the data points that we see on kind of the Bloomberg terminal in terms of unemployment, job growth, you also lend to several dozen fintech companies who lend to several hundreds of thousands of consumers. When you look at the data points and kind of the private data that you're getting, what does it tell you about the economy?
That it's not in a good place. Default rates are going up on the consumer. Consumers are buying less. Consumers are doing, you know, doing with less. They're eating out less. I mean, I don't think the consumer's in great shape. And, you know, maybe it gets covered up by the top half. But if you look at people who are living on a fixed income and, you know, they're talking to you about the prices at Costco, they are going, you know, they're doing less. They're buying less. The prices are up. The portions are smaller. You look at their Costco bill, it's up 100%. I mean, in many cases over the last 5 years, it's pretty crazy. And so we're not seeing the consumer in great shape. We're seeing consumers having defaulted on debt they've taken out. School is, you know, something we spend a lot of time on. It is just unbelievable getting out of the debt burden of school. Like if you think about, you know, option arms back in 08 and the amount of debt that put on people, I think this student loan issue is way bigger than that. And people having to figure out how to be 22 years old and have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt before they even make a dollar. And then they're not easily employable. I don't think the consumer is overall in a good place.
Carrie, tell us a little bit about how you became the person and the entrepreneur you are. Because I think either 22-year-old young women just out of college are listening, or somebody who is related to them might be listening. And I would like to know how you have done what you have done.
A lot of grit. I want every 22-year-old woman to go into finance. Like there needs to be different voices in the room.
Agriculture, no mining, no.
Mining would be just great. But you know, one, I'll never forget, I was 22 years old and I called my dad and I was like, "Dad, I hate this. Why did you tell me to do this?" And he said, if I told you you couldn't, you never would have tried. At least now you have a shot. And, you know, not caring about what people said about me. And it's so hard, but so many people have said so many, you know, tough things about me. Oh, she was going to blow up Third Point. Oh, she doesn't know what she's doing. Oh, she's not competent. Oh, she's just a dumb girl. I've gotten it all. And like I always say, like, it hurts. It's hard. But that has been a big part of it. You throw yourself a pity party. You like mourn the loss of probably a friendship of someone who said this, and you know who they are, and you take the transparency and you move on. But there's something about me that just, when I get knocked down, wants to fight harder.
I can actually see that, Carrie, from across this table. You know, we have a longtime reader named Lisa Hess. And she started out, she's a Harvard lady, and she started out at Goldman Sachs. And she was an early pioneer in what must have been the redoubtable experience of joining a trading desk at Goldman Sachs at the age of 20-something when you were not one of the guys. So one of her first days on the job, somebody just threw his lunch tray with the lunch on it at her because she was there. And in response, she picked up her lunch tray and tossed it right back in his face.
Good for her.
And she said that, and by the way, it was onward and upward from there for Lisa.
So I had someone at Morgan Stanley throw their coffee at me because I got the color of the coffee wrong. Iced coffee. It was iced coffee. Yeah, no, she ordered her coffee the color of the wood on the desk. It was two shades too light, and she was so upset that she threw it back at me when I gave it to her. It was, being on a trading floor at 22 was really tough.
You know, one of my favorite stories in Grants, I must say, we shouldn't toot our own horn, although this is a commercial enterprise. That's allowed, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, Evan, you weren't here, I think, for this particular story. It was 2006. And we were students of Morgan Stanley, which now, by the way, is in tall cotton. I saw the CEO in Davos talking about all the great things. But then they were even taller, higher cotton. They were in all of the fashion forward credit things, you know. And the strategy, I think, was to buff itself up, get prison big, so to speak, and sell itself to some big, dumb bank. That was the idea. So what I saw in going through the financials was a leverage ratio of upwards of 35 times on a statement date in the context of all of this bull market stuff. And we wrote about this, and the headline was "Over the Cliff with Morgan Stanley." and we nailed it.
And they came very close to going bankrupt.
Never mind close. They were done except for the United States Treasury. Goldman Sachs was done except for the Treasury. Citicorp, ditto. Everybody with a big balance sheet and a big reputation, ditto, 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 ditto. Oh, did I mention General Motors? Ditto. Yeah, it was not the greatest moment in American finance or capitalism. But, Terry, if you had been a little younger and had been there, there would have been fewer mistakes made. I guarantee that. So, anyway, I hate to bring this to a close, but we have to go on. We have to do something else today. We can't just sit around and have fun.
I can sit around and have fun all the time.
Yeah, I know you can. It shows in your success and in all the things you've done. So I'm going to say thank you, Kerry, for coming in here. This is a privilege and a pleasure. So thank you, Kerry Findlay.
Thank you for having me.
Come back all over again.
I would love that.
Okay. Evan, I'll see you around the campus.
See you on the campus. And Kerry, thank you again.
Of course. Okay. Thank you.
So long. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Era. And subscribe to Grant's. All right. Over and out.